This is Fortress on a Hill. Thank you for joining us. I'm Henry.
And I'm Danny. We're here to tear apart recent stories about our nation's armed forces and our veterans.
We hope you'll take a critical look at what's happening with our military. And we hope you enjoy the show.
Now, let's get started.
Recommend to people listening? Are there any, you know, Danny and I are always on the hunt for some kind of nuanced war film that actually gives some opposing sides in it, and we generally don't find it. It's just a backlog that glorifies war without any examination.
Boy, I wish I could offer you some great suggestions on that. I mean, since I was a kid, I can remember my dad taking me. I lived in New York City. We used to go down to 42nd Street, movie theaters that had, you know, double and triple feature westerns and war films. I used to watch the old war films with him sitting there, and he would sit there silently. I mean, that generation, the so-called greatest generation, never thought of themselves that way. They didn't talk about their wars really very much. But I saw his wars on screen, and so I thought I knew, you know, they were always glorious. We won. Yeah. It always worked out well. But, you know, so, I mean, I have seen many war films in my life. But American war films, it's hard to think of one to recommend. I mean, there's Apocalypse Now, for instance. But I have some problems with that. I mean, I think it's a distinctly imperfect film. It was an attempt to redo the Vietnam War critically. And, but I think because it chose to do it in the context of Conrad, of his Congo, that Congo novel of his.
Right,
the
Heart of Darkness.
The natives... Yeah, the Heart of Darkness, where the natives are left on the riverbank. Basically, the same thing happened in this film. You know, the Vietnamese are off in some corner somewhere. It's all about Americans. But nonetheless, it certainly is more interesting than most of them. I had one experience as a kid that was unique in America, which was I lived on 58th Street in New York City, and there were it was probably the only street in the United States in the 1950s that had three foreign film houses played foreign films. I knew the manager. I became friendly as a kid with the manager of the film house next to me. He used to let me in everything. So I used to go by myself to all these foreign films. And actually, it's the foreign war films that might be interesting to look at today. I'd have to go back and look at them. But, you know, you'd go see, like, there was a German film called The Bridge, about kids being hustled into Nazi uniforms to fight the Americans in the last days of the war. It was an anti-war film, quite grim, you know, which was striking. The Russians did some. I mean, there was oh God, the cranes are flying. You know, there were some grim and interesting Russian war films. There was Sundays in Cibel, which was the French Algerian War. I mean, I might look at some of those foreign films, but American films, it's not one of the great, you know, it's a great tradition if you like the Marine hymn to start up and the Marines to advance, but otherwise, I would say maybe not.
It's interesting and sort of striking that you would recommend foreign films, although I have to agree, Vietnam created some imperfect art, but at least the Vietnam War created some artistic movies that attempted to grapple with the broader themes, you know, whether it's Platoon or Apocalypse Now or even Deer Hunter in its own way. These are imperfect films that at least tried to look critically at the nature of that war. What's fascinating to Henry and I as we talk about this is that almost all the war movies made about the post 9/11 wars, whether it's The Hurt Locker or American Sniper or Lone Survivor, I mean, essentially, they are two types of stories, sometimes mixed together. And the story is one of basic heroism. And then the second story is the comradeship under fire. And that's about as deep as it goes in the current movies. It's either a flag-waving action-adventure, or if it's a little more complex, it talks about how you might get addicted to combat and how all you have are your brothers. But to me, that's so insufficient because it doesn't, you know, the unspoken elephant in the room in every one of these movies is the Iraqis or the Afghans, who are really dehumanized, and there's no critical look at why we were there. At least a movie like Platoon attempted to look at both the nature of the human condition as well as the complexity of fighting this type of war. There's nothing like that today, and I agree with you, we probably do have to go to the foreign films, which is really an indictment of not only American filmmaking, but also of this American moment that you spoke of in your book, which kind of leads me to the next... Go ahead.
I have to say, I ducked most of the present war films. I just couldn't face them. I mean, I saw previews, and I went, I don't think I can do it. So
you didn't miss much. They make me more angry than anything else. We're talking about American exceptionalism in a weird way, maybe in a darker way, because we're talking about how American films are so lacking when it comes to war. We're also talking about the way America reacted to the post 9/11 moment in this triumphalist way, which made me think of two pieces ago. One of your more recent pieces, you called it The Caliphate of Trump, which was striking. And, you know, you sort of described what it is that makes this president, and I think more importantly, this country in this moment, extreme, you know, to put extreme in quotes. Well, we love the term extremist as it applies to Islamic or Islamist or even white nationalists. We like to throw the word extremist, especially after a religion. So can you kind of discuss your argument in that piece and maybe explain why you think so few Americans see themselves as an extremist nation?
Yes. It's funny. I'll tell you where I started. When I started thinking about that piece, it's something that's been on my mind for years. We know that they, i.e. the Islamist extremists, they have suicide bombers. They've walked into weddings and funerals and whatever and killed people. And it is extreme. It is horrific. You know, those suicide bombers are, you might say, their precision weaponry. But that story you can read here endlessly, you know, because it goes with all the fears of further terrorism and so on and so forth. There's one story that Tom Dispatch has followed over these years that you can find almost nowhere else. I mean, you can find the literal news reports if, like me, you're a news jockey and you're looking for them. But by about 2013 or 2014, I had counted 8 weddings in 3 countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, that U.S. air power had blown to smithereens, sometimes killing bride, groom, musicians at the wedding, whatever. I mean, and they got, you know, some of them got some attention very briefly here. I mean, I remember because I was struck by one of the New York newspapers, the Daily News, when a CIA drone took out a Yemeni wedding party, their headline was a joke headline, Bride and Boom. Now imagine for a minute if some lone wolf Islamic terrorist had walked into an American wedding here and blown up the bride and part of the bridal party and so on and so forth. You would have 3 weeks of 24/7 coverage or something like that until the next horror came along. But this passed in a day as a joke. So, I mean, that's the first thing, is there is a kind of... Only one of those weddings did we ever apologize for. I mean, most of them seem to have had nothing to do with terrorists or anything else. It was mistakes of some sort, or we were just killing people who were gathering. You know, and that, to me, you wipe out at least 8 weddings, that's an act of extremism, you know. And then I look, part of the thing is that our extremism is more, it's more distant from our lives. We don't see much of it, and B, it's kind of systemic. So, for instance, you know, we garrison the globe. Americans never think about this. I mean, we've had up to 1,000 bases. It's now, the estimate now is about 800 around the planet. You know, every continent, everything but our obvious enemies. You know, and they range from American cities to small to tiny, you know, outposts. But this is extraordinary. There's never been an imperial power with this sort of that has ever garrisoned the globe in quite this way. The Brits obviously came closer, but not at this level. I consider that extreme. Funding the military, we put $1 trillion a year, according to there's a guy who writes for Tom Dispatch, William Hartung, who's an expert on the Pentagon and so on. So he put this together. It's probably higher now, but when he did it a few years ago, we were putting $1 trillion into what's called the National Security State, the Pentagon intelligence agencies, all 17 of them, what's now called Homeland Security. That's to put that much money into that. It's given what money doesn't go into. I think of it as an extreme act. We've been fighting wars, 17 years, invasions, occupations, air campaigns, drone strikes, et cetera, never ending. I mean, this is in a world in which the last American victory, arguably, in the world was the taking of the island of Grenada back in what? I don't even remember what year.
1983.
83, thank you very much. It is extreme to fight wars never endingly. And I mean, I'm struck, the Washington Post reported recently that the phrase now on the lips of senior commanders, senior officers, I think was what they said, was infinite war. That's, I mean, not even permanent war anymore. That is war that will never end. It is extreme to think of yourself as fighting never-ending wars. I think those cities I talked to you about, simply, in response for 9/11, that one day's disaster to in essence destroy city after city across the greater Middle East. One is in North Africa, Sirte, in Libya. One is in the Philippines. Now, our Air Force, our Air Force had nothing to do with, but it was another destroyed city. And this is like what our wars have in essence done. Displacing people. So many people have been displaced. I think it's quite startling. I mean, the numbers of refugees, I said before, are just at staggering highs. And that is extreme to do that. For so many children in particular, to have been displaced, to have become refugees, to have lost everything that would be meaningful to a child, the stability of a child's life, that is extreme. Arming the planet. We are an almost monopolistic armor of the planet. When you look at the figures, between 2002 and 2016, we transferred weaponry to 167 countries. That's 85% of the nations on the planet, and a lot of those weapons went to the most, devastating hotspots in the Middle East and so on and so forth. That is fanning the flames. I find that extreme, and so on and so forth. I mean, I think you can make an argument. For it's not the kind of extremism we usually think of as extremism, but we don't think of ourselves. Americans think of this, it's our government, we're fighting our wars, and so on and so forth, but they don't think of these things as extreme. But if you step back for a minute and think, there's a kind of extremity to the particular national security world that we're now in. And it's an extremity for us, and it's even more of an extremity for people at the receiving end.
Absolutely. It's interesting. I think one of the, seminal American character traits, it seems, is a lack of self-awareness, just the lack of the ability to see ourselves in anything close to an accurate frame of mind. Secretary of Defense Mattis, he just released his National Defense Strategy months back. I wrote a piece for you that the Army didn't like, that they have just begun chastising me for, where I sort of critiqued Secretary of Defense Mattis. And I was critiquing his view of the world, and he talks about how there are revisionist powers like Russia and China, and then there are, quote, rogue states, which was a really popular word during the Bush years. And of course, North Korea and Iran were top of the pile. It used to be Iraq as well. And it's hard not to listen to what you're saying, as well as to read your article, The Caliphate of Trump, without wondering if America is truly the roguest of rogue states in the world, seen through a certain prism.
I think you could make that argument, at least. Yes. I mean, but it's not a prism we ever look through. So it sounds like a kind of an extreme argument here, but I don't think it actually is. I think it makes sense.
Well, I wonder about people in the same generation as Danny and I, but have no military friends and have no, they watch all the movies that we've been talking about. They've been watching The Hurt Locker. They've been watching Zero Dark Thirty. So by the time they actually get to one of us who has some kind of counterpoint, they've received 17 plus years of propaganda, essentially. And especially if they have military friends, veteran friends that really say this is necessary, it's it's really hard when everybody has been received that much input over that long period of time without actually touching anything, anybody who was actually affected, any other counter views. That's like my favorite movie when I was younger was Black Hawk Down. But there is no counter view in that film. There is no counter any of that to balance it out. And that's the hardest thing for Americans to do, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, that is, of course, in its own modest way, what Tom Dispatch does try to do. But as you point out, you know, I mean, obviously, most people don't read Tom Dispatch. You know, so not an issue.
No, I've had a couple little short arguments with a former squad leader of mine since Danny and I've started the podcast, and I usually enjoy it. I mean, it's not super nasty or anything, but he really, really doesn't like some of the anti-war stuff I put out, and I like having that discussion with him.
Well, I have to say, one of the things that I actually am proud of at Tom Dispatch is, you know, I've always felt that people who have made it through, you know, who have had the in these years that military experience from inside the military and come out of it with a critical point of view have something, you know, incredibly valuable to offer the rest of us. And that's something at Tom Dispatch that I have tried to forefront. I mean, over the years, there are a number of, you know, well, Danny is the exception because he's still in the military. They're former military people who got out of the came out of the military with a perspective on what indeed our wars, our national security, our obsession with national security, and so on and so forth is all about. And I think that perspective is invaluable.
Absolutely. So, want to shift gears a little bit here and go back to the Iraq War for a second. During that era, say, you know, 2001 to 2008, the only combat veteran I remember in the Bush administration was Colin Powell, and yet he participated in everything pushing for the war alongside Dick Cheney and the rest. But they specifically use his clout as a general and as a combat veteran to sell the war. Now, in that same period of time, Eric Shinseki was forced to resign after telling Congress how many troops were needed to invade Iraq, despite being proven right many, many times over by history. But Powell chose to play that part to the bitter end. And we're seeing active duty people at times expressing dissent in some very impactful ways. Danny is a great example. Simone Askew and the group of black female West Point cadets holding up their fists for police violence, you know, another great example. My question to you would be, what do you think are the most powerful acts of dissent that active military and veterans can take? How best can veteran cred be used today to help the anti-war movement?
Well, I'd say two things. One is I just have to say something about myself, and something about Tom Dispatch, which is Tom Dispatch offers kind of pieces that try to offer you a different framework way of thinking about our world. But the one thing it doesn't do, and the one thing I basically don't do, is I basically don't tell people what the hell they should do.
Sure.
You know, I figure that there's something I sometimes see about the world that I think is different and that's worth telling people about. But I don't think I have any special, you know, access to what people should do. And so I kind of avoid that. So I don't think I can tell you what military people should do. I think people know that for themselves.
Sure.
If they have that feeling that they should do something, they have a sense of what, you know. I think the only thing I would ever say about people is, you know, don't go beyond your own moral compass, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Do something that's within the realm of what you feel is you know, just don't you know. I think, you know, even small things can matter a great deal. The real problem isn't what any individual military person should do in terms of an anti-war movement. The real problem is that since March, April 2003, or maybe a little beyond, when, if you remember, leading up to the invasion of Iraq, there was the largest anti-war movement probably globally in history, I mean, it was on the streets of, I was part of it. It was on the streets of American cities, but also global cities. Millions of people went out to say the obvious, which is, don't do it. This isn't going to work. To say something that was right and something, you know, and all the people who said, you know, who were writing that we should do it. I mean, some of them have offered kind of mea culpas, but they're still writing. They're still being asked for their opinions. People who went out and said, don't do it, are no longer, they were never asked their opinions again, basically. But an enormous number of people went out. After that moment, yes, small groups, Code Pink, some small anti-war vet groups and so on, there basically hasn't been an anti-war movement. I mean, the striking thing about this period is Americans, you know, George Bush, after 9/11, one of the more striking things he said was he told his advice to the American people, and this was relatively quickly after 9/11, he said people should, it was either go to Disneyland or Disney World, I'd have to look it up, but right. He told people they should go to Disney World, I think, and they should continue their lives, they should continue, in essence, to consume, they should, in other words, The thing this government has done is it has fought its wars while telling people to go right on with their lives. Nobody has been, there have been no war taxes, there have been no war drives, no war bond drives, there's not never been the equivalent of the World War II victory gardens, nothing. You know, these wars are fought without relation, without, almost in a way that, except for the American people, that they should thank the warriors, the heroic warriors, endlessly. That's the one thing Americans are supposed to do. They're supposed to thank the military. Other than that, Americans aren't supposed to do anything. They're mobilized for absolutely nothing. And the sad thing is that they have not, in these years, basically mobilized themselves, either in or out of the military. I mean, there are exceptions, and there are some, you know, moving military exceptions to that, vet groups and so on. But when I think back to the Vietnam era, where the anti-war movement by the last years of that era was being led both by military vets and by people who were still in the military. I mean, the military was aboil with protest by the final years of the Vietnam War. It was startling. I mean, there was a military figure, a guy named Robert Heinel, who wrote at the time in Armed Forces Journal, and he compared the American military as Vietnam was in the latter stages of the Vietnam War. He compared it to the Tsarist Army of Russia in 1917 and the French Army in 1917, which was also, both of which were armies who seemed to be, well, the Russian Army simply disintegrated. The French Army was racked by revolts and so on and so forth. He was not writing a sympathetic article. He was a military man writing an article about the, you know, trying to just catch the nature of the uproar. There's been nothing faintly similar. And that, as I say, is, I think, largely was the result of the ending of the draft.
So, Tom, that leads into my next question. I was going to ask you to sort of tell the listeners about your experience in the Vietnam generation, you know, the protests, the sit-ins, the anti-war journalism and such. And we've already talked about it, how it compares to today. But you know, you interviewed some soldiers, is that correct, at one point during the end of the war? What was that experience like?
Ah, well, you know, we had, you know, the thing is that the anti-war movement at that time was significantly a military movement. So, I mean, I worked at a place, it was an alternate, was an anti-war press, I suppose you'd say. It was a place called Pacific News Service, which closed only recently, actually. It went on for years. And it was the West Coast version of Dispatch, Dispatch was the place that released Seymour Hersh's My Lai. Revelations, and we then set ourselves up, the fellow who did it said, I came to work there, set itself up as the West Coast version of that, and you know, we had guys in Vietnam writing for us. I remember there was a guy who wrote for us under anonymously, and the Pentagon tried to track him down. They looked up everybody named, I don't know, Weintraub or whatever it was in Vietnam to try to track him down, which they couldn't because it wasn't really his name. But we had, you know, I lived in a world of, you know, that was in which, you know, basically GIs were passing through all the time. That was what it was like then, you know.
It's so interesting because it is so different today in the service.
It's completely different.
I think Henry and I could both speak. You know, Henry as a veteran, me as a veteran, and soon to be, you know, career ended officer. There are relatively few of us, and if you do speak out against the war, and Henry, you can back me up here. One of the common refrains or retorts is, "Well, you volunteered. Why are you complaining?"
Right.
Which is a massive logical fallacy. I mean, it's just full of problems. But it makes sense intuitively to so many people who think on the surface. And
it also makes sense in terms of what I was just saying, which is that you can trace so much of this back to the fact that we created an all-volunteer military, which would function almost, you might say, although nobody thinks of it this way. Actually, I had a military man, an ex-military man, who wrote for Tom Dispatch and used this years ago, William Astori, who was an Air Force lieutenant colonel. He described the American military in these years, this was years ago, as a... basically, he compared it to the French Foreign Legion. I mean, it's not a literal comparison, but in terms of it being sent into foreign lands and left to do its damnedest without any particular, you know, response at home.
I really like that analogy, and I can't help but wonder if in the American case, it's almost like, you know, in many cases, people from the French Foreign Legion either came from other countries or were natives of French colonial possessions. In the United States, we are sort of a foreign legion, except we're sort of internally colonized. What we've done is we've taken people from the South, the Southeast, the Deep South, and the far Mountain West, by and large. We've taken people from these small towns, created military castes, sort of families, and then put them into this utterly professionalized force and sent overseas to do our bidding. And once we're sent overseas, we're not to be heard from again. You know, they don't want to hear our complaints. You're just there to do a job. The job may never end. And very similar to the French Foreign Legion, there isn't a lot of discussion in the streets of Paris about what the Foreign Legion is doing. And there isn't a lot of discussion in the streets of New York City about what the professionalized U.S. Army is doing. And it's very, very discouraging.
Exactly right. Yes.
So, Tom, I heard a journalist I follow recently on YouTube refer to Barack Obama and Joe Biden as war criminals for their continuation of the CIA drone program. And I found that among anti-war circles, the term war criminal can get passed around and even diluted in its use. Bashar al-Assad is definitely a war criminal in my definition, but not to the extent that a massive invasion of his country is warranted. However, now we're using that description to push regime change in Syria. My question for you is, do you think the term and others like it, you know, baby killer, mass murder, or anything like that, do you think that we've used them too much, that misusing them has wrung out their meaning over 17 years, especially when dealing with people like Mike Pompeo or John Bolton, who take those titles and weaponize their use in the media?
I will just, again, personally, I just figure I am not a judge and jury of some international tribunal, so I probably would not use the phrase, you know, war criminal in terms of Barack policy. But, what I would do is use just more descriptive terms. I mean, for instance, in 2012, when I read, it was the New York Times, you know, breaking story, that Barack Obama in the White House presided over what were called Terror Tuesday meetings, where they had so-called baseball cards with the bios of suspected terrorists on them, and they discussed these, and they put people onto what was called a kill list, and then the CIA's drones were sent out to try and kill them wherever they were in the world, more or less, I mean, relatively speaking. I wrote a piece called Assassin in Chief because I realized at that moment that, you know, Chalmers Johnson, who wrote Blowback, and who was a most interesting man, he used to refer to the CIA as the president's private army. Well, that drone air force is the CIA's, is the president's private air force now, functionally. And the idea that an American president would have such an air force and would be able to send it anywhere on Earth to assassinate somebody, so-called, they're usually called targeted killings, or targeted strikes, but basically it's an assassination. I realized it wasn't just Barack Obama, but any American president, Donald Trump, is now assassin-in-chief. He's actually upped the... Tom DeSantis has an article about it today. He's upped the drone. You know, again, very little attention is paid to these drone killings here, but in essence, even though assassinations are theoretically illegal, were made illegal after Watergate, you know, not political assassinations, we, in essence, do assassinate people around the world by drone, and so any president from now into the distant future, as long as this situation exists, will functionally be, among other things, an assassin-in-chief. That's a phrase I would use.
It's very interesting that you use the term assassination to show how insecure and sort of touchy the military is. One of the first articles I wrote, very soon after starting writing for you, I wrote a piece for War on the Rocks about not letting Barack Obama off the hook for his crimes, or maybe a better word is just for his, you know, his militarism. And I thought it was important that we not let him off the hook as liberals, that we shouldn't just give him a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent the article through the public affairs office at Fort Leavenworth to a lieutenant colonel who outranked me. Mm-hmm. And his job is to make sure that it's acceptable for consumption. And he didn't agree with most of what I had to say, and he let me know that. But he said everything I was doing was within regulation, but that the general, he had shown this article. He knew it was sort of going to be controversial if he'd shown it to the one-star general, second in command of the post. And he said, this is what he told me. He said, General Kim really would like you to use a different word than assassination with respect to the drone program. He said he can't make you, because technically I was correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said, but he would really like you to change it to targeted killing. And that to me was just this, what a moment in my head. I said, wow, they're the euphemism factory that we've become at this point, where we're so touchy about it. But that's exactly what he is. You're right. Assassin-in-chief is a perfect title, not only for Obama, not only for Trump, but for American presidents from now until potentially eternity.
Yeah, until wherever. Absolutely. Yeah. And they have embraced it. I mean, Trump has now embraced this. I mean, and in fact, he's done something. I mean, you know, in the Obama period, it was kept within the presidential sphere, and he's now given the okay for such assassinations, such targeted strikes, to take place, to be ordered without presidential approval, basically. So he's actually expanded the thing.
Right. Well, Henry, do you have any other questions? I think we've got some great stuff.
There?
I want to let you, Henry. Yeah. Do you have one more?
I do. I got one more, if that's okay.
Okay.
Great.
I feel very strongly we're on the verge of a new conflict with Iran, but our military is nowhere near the size needed to do such a mission. Not that that stopped us before. We're already seeing U.S. use of proxy forces abroad, and when that invasion of Iran comes, do you believe that America will kind of collectively exhale and go on with their day, or is there a chance that the size and scale of what's needed to invade Iran could breach some of those thought bubbles on views about endless war?
Well, you know, the first thing is, this is just me, you know, again, I the future is dim. So, I agree with you completely. I mean, it was obvious now that you have two people. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, the adult in the room now on an invasion of Iran is James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, because we know that the Secretary of State, Pompeo, and the National Security Advisor, Bolton, are both raging Iranophobes. And so the adult is Mattis. And Mattis, you know, he was basically, well, not quite fired, but let's say quietly relieved of his post as U.S. CENTCOM, Central Command Commander, which was the area that would have included Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Iran, and so on and so forth, because he was obsessed with Iran. He was obsessed. He wanted to launch a plan to take out an Iranian oil refinery or power plant. He was angry because the Iranians, he felt, were giving arms to Iraqi militias that were killing American soldiers. So he himself, I mean, the sanest person in Washington now on a war with Iran is a man who, in another context, would have been considered an obsessive about attacking Iran. So that's where we are. So I agree with you that the urge to somewhere along the line go at it with Iran beyond sanctions and so on and so forth is there. I doubt that there would be, a la Iraq 2003, a full-scale American invasion of Iran. I don't think that, even for these guys, I don't think that will be in the cards. I think we're really talking about a potentially major air war. Maybe with, I don't think the other troops are there. I mean, you would not have enough American, as you say, I don't think you could even gather an invasion force. You can't. The Saudis wouldn't do it. The Israelis are not going to send their troops there. All of them would be happy to see Iran go down. But I do think something is going to happen. And I always think, there's some question we always have to, after all these years, every time something like this has happened, it's led to another spiraling disaster. So, you want to ask a question. There was a guy who wrote for Town Dispatch for quite a while, an ex State Department guy, who always used to write in his piece. He always used to use the phrase, what could possibly happen? Or what could possibly go wrong? Sardonically. Because, of course, we already know. We know, yes, you could level Tehran, you could do whatever, but that will not do what Washington thinks it should do. And this, while we don't know what would happen, none of this can end well, and that Washington cannot, will not get through its head.
Yeah, I really like that phrase, this cannot end well. It reminds me of General Petraeus, who is really seen as like a fount of wisdom within the military, which
yes.
I suppose compared to so many other, knuckle draggers that really do populate the upper ranks of the military, he is an intelligent man, but he famously supposedly tells a reporter in a helicopter, tell me how this ends in 2003 when he's first taken over northern Iraq.
Yes.
And I can't help but wonder, he's now taken to calling Afghanistan a generational war, but...
A generational struggle is his actual
right.
phrase.
Right, generational struggle.
Yeah.
Now I wonder if he would even ask that question. I don't think he would. I think that Iran is just another example of how this war can continue to grow and feed itself. Because every time the Romans took a new province, they found out that now they had to secure that province and that there was a new enemy further to the east or further to the north. And I can't help but wonder if we're doing the same thing.
The only thing about the Romans is they actually did secure the provinces, at least for a period.
Right.
We are not. We are not securing the provinces. That's what the U.S. military has been unable to do. I mean, we are creating a series of either failed states or semi-failed states. I mean, 15 years, isn't it? Like 14 or 15 years after the invasion of Iraq, the Iraqis have finally had an election, and the two top winners were Muqtada al-Sadr, who... fought you, Danny,
killed
when
two
you
of my
were
soldiers.
When you were exactly, and the second winner was the guy who's totally associated with the pro-Iranian militias in Iraq. Now, is that a happy ending to the American story in Iraq? I doubt it.
And I think you're absolutely right that the future is dim. It's very difficult to predict. But what we can be almost certain of is that were we to engage in a regime change or a lengthy air war with Tehran, we would probably find ourselves with similarly totally predictable, unpredictable circumstances
and we would have destroyed more places that will take forever to rebuild. And the lives of more people, and this is a terrible thing. And you have to wonder, what the hell are we doing after all these years? That seems like a reasonable place, don't you think, to end?
I think so. I think so, Tom. We want to thank you so much for coming on. I want to personally thank you for the opportunities you've given to me, and listeners out there, pick up Tom's book of essays, A Nation Unmade by War. Go to tomdispatch.com, throw it in your favorites. You won't regret it. I started reading it when I was in Afghanistan on a very, very shitty internet connection, and I've never turned back. So please do it. And Tom, thanks again.
I just want to, can I correct one thing before we get off the air?
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
You put what you just said about what you had done in the past tense, but I just want to point out to people that, you know, I will be publishing pieces of yours at Tom Dispatch until, I can't say hell freezes over, but until, as I'm heading towards 74 years, until at least I freeze over. Okay?
Right. Perfect. Perfect. That's, yeah,
Chris,
that's a deal.
Thank you all so very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Thank
it
you,
was
Tom.
Wonderful to meet you and talk to you.
Bye.
All right, Tom. All right. Hey, we'll talk soon, Tom.
Thank you for joining us today. Please come join the conversation at www.fortressonahill.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill or on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Fortress on a Hill. We want to hear from our listeners about the topics and issues pertinent to America's military and veteran communities. And last but certainly not least, analyze your news and its sources very closely. Verify everything you read. And remember that no one, no matter how powerful, are above criticism, especially those with the power to send others into harm's way. We'll see you next time.